Well, hey, everybody. This is Dave. I know I'm a little bit early. I'm excited about our meeting today. So much has happened in the 3 months between February 3rd, our first meeting of this year, our last quarterly mentor group, May the 4th, and especially to today. So I hope all of you are doing good, and I'm eager to hear from you about wins, progress notes, success stories, as well as any announcements. And then I want to reserve just a bit of time for us to use in a mastermind way about any questions you'd like to ask our group. Half past the hour, our special guest, Linda Graham, will be joining us. Just a preview of coming attractions. Our next mentor group, we have a special guest from South Africa, one of our own, with some unique ways to think about applying some of our material and coaching. After that, I'm thinking about, I'd like your input, if you would like to hear or have actually a white paper on extreme success. It's one of the things that I don't see much of anything written about, but that we deal with in coaching. Increasingly, I think, we'll deal with things like success anticlimax, the summit syndrome, and transformational coaching, things having to do with extreme success. And I'm wondering if you're interested in that. Let me know at some point if you are. And I know we have some wins and progress notes, some announcements. Gloria, you're first up. Would you like to make an announcement and talk about what you have going?
Surely, yes.
Welcome.
So, thank you. Hi, everyone. We are launching this week. We've been working on it for months. Launching Leap to Prosperity Virtual Summit for Women. Free. It's free. And it is 5 days of looking at the whole idea of prosperity. And who better to do that with than David? Dave, he is going to be interviewed, and I am so excited about it because it's called An Interview in the Neuroscience of Prosperity for Women. So how do women see prosperity different than men? And so Dave, as he always does, just got into that subject and has come up with a white paper.
Only because Gloria nudged me and kept nudging me, so I decided, okay.
I'm not easy to get rid of, but he's in the financial health area, and I did send a document to you, David, to share with everyone. It has the link to the summit, because everybody can start pre-registering right now, actually, but it also has a little blurb about your interview. Do you want me to read it?
I think everybody on the line already knows more about my opinion than I do, and I, you know, but that's, no, I'm teasing. That's up to you. Whatever you feel would give people the best scope. You have a whole range of a lot of really outstanding people.
I don't, doctors and, just a lot of women that coaches that have introduced something really spectacular to the summit. It's amazing. So I'm looking forward to getting feedback and have everybody get on there and take a look at it. But there's your link is on this page. So if you wanted to pass that on to everybody, you can do that. It's got both pictures of the interview, and then there's one that you can use for post, but we'll explain that to you later. So it says, this interview with David Kruger, MD and executive mentor coach, is hosted by Renee Dineen, an organizational psychologist and high-performance leadership coach. Through their conversation, women will begin to discover how to apply human dynamics, psychology, and neuroscience to create essential transformation of their money, career, relationship, and wellness stories that will take their lives to the next level. Dr. Kruger and Renee will have an informative and lively discussion. Creating, and these are the items, the list of what you gave me from your research, creating your prosperity mindset, transforming your concept of prosperity, unlearning what you know, taking advantage of your brain's neuroplasticity, playing to win versus playing not to lose, understanding the behavioral economics of prosperity for women. In the summit, prosperity is defined as embracing a healthy, meaningful, thriving life. The key word is embracing. It asserts we willingly and enthusiastically accept and support the idea of prospering in all areas of life. And then Dr. Kruger and Renee will discuss powerful discoveries rooted in neuroscience on how changing your mind can change your brain to embrace prosperity. So that's a little promo on the actual interview. And we don't have a date for the interview. I shouldn't say that we do have. It's 5 days. David's on day 4. So.
And I want to add, Renee also happens to be the daughter of Gloria, and of all the interviews I've done, from being a shrink to being a coach, there have been two people who have been most outstanding. One was 25 or more years ago, and that was Daniel Goldman, who later came to his own fame with things like emotional intelligence. The other is Renee. She is an outstanding interviewer, and the one time we've done this before was really a creatively exciting time, and she's terrific at what she does. In addition to being Gloria's daughter, there may be some relationship there.
Yeah, well, she's better than I am at most things, so that's good. That's what I wanted for her. In any case, yeah, and she loves you, and as I do, she thinks, you know, so she so honors her time with you. So that's all good. You know, it shows up in the interview, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, good.
Super.
Well, that's
thanks,
it.
Gloria.
So, get on. Yeah, get that over to all your people, and let's just see, you know, let's just get them pre-registered. There's a lot of bonuses to pre-register. And the actual event is until September 23rd, so.
Yeah, this is a huge contribution, and as Gloria mentioned, it's free. I'll be sending in a follow-up note to this mentor group, our reunion, I'll be following up with some information about how to do that and link and that sort of thing. So watch for that. It'll be within a day or so as soon as my IT guy posts the recording. So thanks very much. That's a great priming of the pump for announcements and things happening. Who else? I'm eager to hear from a number of you. What you got going?
David, it's Eric Jack here, David. How are you?
Go for it, Eric. How are you?
Good. First of two calls today.
Okay.
Got the 7 o'clock call tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I have a lot going on. The first thing is my new book, which is called the Ultimate Leadership Workbook, Creating the 21% Leader, will be out in early October. It's in final editing stage now, and Dave very kindly agreed to endorse the book, which I'm very excited about. It really is about helping every leader become, no matter their industry, no matter their background, become the best leader they can be based on 21 different characteristics, 7 of which are core, 14 of which can be, you know, really things that are to be developed. And that's coming out in October, along with the launch of several online courses that are related to that, including some smaller courses, which I call 10.5, which, of course, is half of 21. And the second thing is, and this just happened this week, I am going back to my roots, and I'll be hosting a radio show beginning September 2nd, which, of course, will be called the Ultimate Leadership Show. And it's going to be all about leadership. We're going to have interesting guests. Talk about key leadership issues and across all spectrums and areas. I'm really excited about that. And of course, that'll be streamlined, to my online platform, my website. Dave, can I give my website address?
Sure, go for it and send it to me, and I'll follow up with the note to everyone. But go ahead.
Okay, it is www.jtd, J like James, T like Todd, D like David, .com. At jtdcoaching.com. I'm sorry.
Okay. And send it to me as well, because it's easier to click.
Of course I will, sure.
Write some stuff.
That's cool.
Well, that's great.
Sure.
And a throwback to radio. Eric, I've been told I have a face made for radio, so this is going to be great.
Well, you know, I used to do an overnight sports talk show back in college, and I used to joke that I put more people asleep than anyone in America.
Okay, well, that's neat.
So I can relate.
Thanks for the update, Eric. That's great. Well, who else? What you guys doing? Anybody just want to say hi? You don't have to have any big monumental stuff. Just do a check-in. I know there are a number of people on the call.
Well, this is PJ, and I'm from Houston, and I just want to say hello. I'm so grateful to be here, and I'm just congratulating everyone who's got some exciting things going on. I look forward to contributing just as soon as I can.
Well, that's great. Well, you know, PJ has already contributed. We did a gig at the Unity Church here in Houston, so we have met face-to-face, one of the few people in the group, other than those who have come to retreats or workshops. So thanks for saying hi and doing that. So we'll be eager to hear your announcement of moving on. So thanks, PJ. Who else?
Hello, Dave. This is Carolyn Hodge-West. I just want to say hello. I am actually getting ready to do some work with some young people, yay, who want to do a podcast with me. So I'm going to see where that turns out. I did have a little setback. I was finishing up my book about writing, a course about writing a book with you, and I did lose my mom, and not to COVID, thank God. So I'm just sort of regrouping right this second, but very hopeful and still looking forward.
Well, thanks for joining, and sorry to hear about your mom. Tell the group what the nature of your coaching work is.
So thank you, Dave. I'm an executive mentor coach, and I started out coaching college students as an adjunct instructor, but since that time I've worked with individual clients and from mostly women business owners, but just recently, like 2 days ago, I got a call from somebody in broadcast television and brand marketing who is interested in working with me. So, and I'm working with a company out in L.A., which everything's on hold right now, but looking to conduct workshops with their employees to help them sort of retool and find their genius and bring it to bear in terms of performance and optimal performance and efficiency. So branching out, I just got a call, believe it or not, from the college again, wanting me to come in and do some diversity coaching with the college.
Thank you to you and to each of you who share success stories and best practices. I think it can be very stimulating and hopeful, and looking at what kind of things work maybe can catalyze various ideas or notions about what to do for anyone. So I really welcome sharing your success stories, your experiences of what's worked for you and what you've learned and what you have to offer or even nudge the group with. So thanks very much, Carolyn. Who else? What about if no other wins or updates or just check-ins? Final call?
Hey, Dick, this is Joe.
Hey, Joe, how are you? Go ahead.
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you. Some wins for me, as far as my coaching practice, I work with people living with type 2 diabetes, and I'm also a type 2 diabetic veteran. I'm going to say veteran. I'm a veteran, retired veteran, but one that lives with diabetes too. So the Veteran Affairs Medical Center partnered with a company called Virta Health, and their whole idea is that they can reverse type 2 diabetics through eating a low carb diet, more high fat and protein, and they have gotten people off their insulin and their metformin within 3 to 4 months up to a year based upon, you know, each individual. So with that said, the Veteran Affairs had partnered with them, and they opened up the program for veterans where the VA would pay for the program up to a year. And so they took the first 400, and I missed the first 400. And I'm more like Gloria, you know, I'm like always on. I'm like, can you open up for more people? Can you open up for more people? And through Keith asking that question, they opened up 70 more slots, and I was able to get into the additional 70. And through that, they actually asked me to be a mentor or an ambassador between the VA and Virta Health with this program. So that was exciting for me, that I became like a net bothering about, I want to get in this program, to now they're asking me to be a mentor. So that's good news for me, and I'm excited about that. And then there's a local hospital here where I'm at in the D.C. area. I donated some diabetes educational material to them. And through talking with their Diabetes Learning Center, they asked me if I would want to facilitate their classes in the Diabetes Center and be as a PRN as a as needed basis. And so those two things just came up recently in the last couple of months during this pandemic. And so I'm excited about that, and loving what I'm doing.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks for sharing. I want to highlight this is an excellent example of some application. You can't get any more specific than the niche that Joe mentioned, type 2 diabetic veterans. That's a terrific example of a niche, because you know exactly where the watering holes are. You know the ecosystems. You know, and because of his experience and his experience as a wellness coach, it's a perfect application and a focus for a wellness coach. And to develop that with specific offerings that can be of benefit, a great illustration of one way of going about getting contacts, developing that, and offering your best practices and possibilities. So congratulations, and thanks for sharing. That's inspirational. Super. Who else? Don't be shy.
Hey, Dave. This is Lisa Manyoki.
Hey, Lisa. How are you?
Hi, everybody. Good to hear you, Dave. And to the other our other colleague who lost her mom. I did, too, a few weeks ago, and it was the result of COVID. It's a crappy situation, so my sympathies. I have some big news. I finished up, you know, we've talked about presence intelligence before, but I actually finished up what I'm calling an insight inventory. It's not an assessment. It's nothing judgmental. Nobody gets pigeonholed into an avatar or type, but it's rather a pretty comprehensive inventory of different parts of life that would contribute to your a good or positive personal presence. So far, it's available to individuals who are having a personal presence challenge, but it's proving to be a real popular tool for coaches in the life, business, executive, and career space, because it gives them a instant snapshot of where their clients might be contributing to getting in their own way, whether it's the aesthetics of attire, image, or if it's speaking or writing skills, or just not having enough support in their lives. Trying to build something like this is like giving birth, and I'm very happy that it's over, but it feels really good. I'll be happy to share a link. I'll email it to you so you can share it with the group.
If you would, and I think presence intelligence, which is trademarked, copyrighted, is a huge offering and benefit, and I totally applaud efforts to try and not try, but to bring about metrics for blind spots, unconscious biases, especially the kind of application that Lisa is talking about. I think it's a huge contribution, and I think it's something that that we can certainly benefit from, and I look forward to sending on her information to you in a follow-up note as well. So thanks, Lisa, and it's great to hear from you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I'll listen now.
Okay. Yeah, don't try to sneak away. What else? What about any challenges any of you have or would like to bring a question to our group and use it kind of as a mastermind group? We've got maybe 10 minutes left before our special guest comes. How can we be of help to you in thinking about developing any kind of group wisdom around a challenge that you'd like to share?
I have a question, actually. This is Carolyn. And my question is about...
I'm sorry, this is who?
Carolyn. Sorry, Carolyn.
Yeah, Carolyn, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So my question is about conducting workshops. And, you know, I took the workshop in a box training through CTA. And, you know, I'm just curious if anybody's been really successful in that venue and what are some of the hallmarks that if you had to do a look back and consider what you did well, what did you do well and what would you recommend avoiding?
Great question. Who else has taken the CTA? I have not. Who else has taken the CTA workshop in a box course?
This is Carol. I have actually.
Go ahead. You want to share your experience and what's worked and not?
I'm sort of new to coaching right now. I mean, it's kind of a new venture, and I've got my feelers out for all sorts of things, specifically creating an online workshop, getting my social media up and so forth. And I just felt that particular workshop I just didn't feel aligned with it in some way. I don't know how else to explain it, but it wasn't talking to me the way I needed to hear it, I suppose.
Okay. Carolyn, how are you thinking about developing an idea to apply it? Are you going to do a Zoom conference as opposed to a live? What are you thinking about at this point?
So my thoughts are, given the new normal, I think it's fair to anticipate that we're going to have to reinvent the way we deliver above and beyond just doing the phone call sessions with our clients, but to try to reach larger groups and have greater efficiency across the board for both the companies we work for as well, or individuals, as well as just, you know, how to have the greatest impact. And so I was thinking that I would, you know, do things because we know that the small business community has been largely affected by the COVID crisis, in addition to obviously personal financial situations. But my thinking was that I could do a workshop where I could target small business owners who are in transitioning from pre-COVID to post-COVID, and what they need to do to kind of get up and running, sort of the mindset that has to be in place in order to make sure that happens. And I wanted to do that as a workshop so that, you know, maybe limit it to initially, I'm going to say, between 50 and 100 people. And that could be way ambitious, but because I have a background in business and small business in particular, I thought that might be a really good venue. So I registered for Zoom. I do have a Zoom page. And I know there are a lot of other venues out there, which I'm not familiar with just yet, but I'm working on it. And so I wanted to be able to do that. I'm sorry, that's a long way to answer that question, but that's what I'd like to do.
Well,
take it to small business affinity groups and that sort of thing.
Okay, and that's a good answer. You bring up something I was going to recommend to each of you is pick a platform, and Zoom is probably the most universal. Pick a platform like Zoom and really get familiar with it. Get familiar with how to do breakout sessions, how to do various aspects of having conferences on Zoom in addition just to the one-on-one. So the more familiar you are with that, it won't be a limitation when you begin to think about what's the best way, the best application, the best connection to a specific group, and to really hone in on that group and delivering what you think would be of greatest benefit without any kind of snags, technically, so that you can think about absolutely what's the best possibility. So thanks for sharing. Any other input or ideas about that? Because this is certainly the, you know.
This is Lisa again. I have really quick tips on that note. Is it Carolyn?
Yeah.
Don't do it alone. 50 or 100 people is too ambitious a size for a first crack at it. Chances are strong you might have you technology issues, and when you do, the crowd becomes an angry mob. So I've been on enough of these calls, and I've done them. Have somebody else manage the chat. Make sure a group – start out with maybe a group of anywhere between 6 and 12. And stop there. They'll be much more forgiving if you run into a snag. And the last thing you want to deal with is refunds if you're trying to charge for it. And also make sure that people have to register. Don't just put an open Zoom link anywhere on a Facebook page or in an email. Make certain that they have to register, because that gives you a listing of attendees who you will let in rather than any old person bootlegging your event and potentially doing some things you don't want seen. There have been some awful intrusions. But definitely don't do – more than anything, do not do it alone.
Okay. So when you say do not do it alone, you mean have a co-presenter with me, or are you saying you need somebody to handle the technology piece of it?
Handle the technology, manage the chat. Even somebody who is watching the crowd, you can tell who's engaging, who's checked out and whatnot. Interactivity is really key, because if it's too much think tank and if it's too much listening, they're going to reach their absorption cap and you're going to lose them. So you have to break – there's actually recommendations of pacing where every – just for a certain amount of time, maybe 30 minutes of talk, then have them do something that they actually have to do.
This is Gloria, and I do these all the time, but I give them a participant guide, like a little workbook that they can print out and use in real time to just take notes for themselves. And also, Zoom has a webinar. You can use a Zoom webinar, and that whole process is there.
Okay. Thank you both. Very informative, very useful. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. I really want to highlight using the Zoom webinar. They really go through the steps and the paces, and Lisa's point about having someone complimentary, especially someone who's tech savvy, who can work with you as a manager, as an overseer to handle the technology, is really ideal. So great tips.
That's great advice.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
This is PJ, and I would like to add to all of the excellent information that we've already heard. When you register for Zoom, whether you have a free account or a paid account, Zoom has bunches of webinars. So to help you navigate, just to know how the program, how the app.
Yeah, great.
For all the stuff that they offer. And especially before you pay for a Zoom instruction account. I haven't had to do that yet because Zoom's programs are so comprehensive. They also have some learning instructional guides on YouTube that are much easier to follow, because they have screenshots. They show you how to set up breakout rooms and how to navigate the chat, and what you about the chat is really important to not go it alone, and to start small and make all your mistakes there, maybe a freebie or what have you, to just kind of get started and know where the potholes are in the road. The other thing is to know that if you are the host, then you have to run the meeting. If you have a co-host, which it seems like we're all recommending, then the co-host can run the background stuff, the chat and the participants, who's got their hands raised, and muting all the participants, which I also think is crucial. And while you navigate
while you run the meeting. So, but the thing to remember is the host is the one who has all the privileges. Screen sharing, muting everybody, monitoring the chat, who's got their hand raised. The host has access to all of those controls, not the co-host. And one last thing I want to mention is that as far as the chat goes, of course you can save the chat. It's important to know that the host sees all of the chats, not just the chats to everyone, but the private chats that go on through individuals. So if you choose to download and share the chat with the attendees, go through it and make sure that everything you want to share, that nothing you choose not to share is included in that chat. So there's a whole bunch of stuff behind the scenes, but I think from what people have shared here, that'll be enough to get you started with the stuff you don't know you don't know.
That's great. That's great, PJ. And now people know why I didn't get away with nothing on PJ's conference. Thank you very much for sharing that. Immensely, immensely useful to each of you. Thanks so much. Let me pause now. Has Linda arrived?
I'm here.
Welcome. Hey, let me do just a brief introduction and indicate if you have questions or comments, jot them down. She's going to reserve some time at the end for a conversation. I'm really excited about introducing Linda Graham. I was first introduced to Linda's work as a book gift from one of the coaches I've trained, who likely is on the call, Kay McConney, Executive Minds. It was a book of appreciation for her training and individual mentor coaching. It was a double gift, actually, as I saw the value of Linda's work and then had her as an expert content contributor in my mastermind group of coaches that I train. Her first book, an award-winning book, Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being, which I sent you the name of and link to, shows her work of integrating neuroscience, interpersonal neurobiology, attachment theory, positive psychology, resilience training, and post-traumatic growth. That may sound a little bit familiar to all of you. Linda subsequently has published a companion book focusing on application and exercises, resilience, powerful practices for bouncing back disappointment, difficulty, and even disaster. And you hear how Linda's work has been made for these times. I'm very honored to introduce an esteemed colleague to interact with all of us today. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, David. Hello, everyone. I'm Linda Graham.
Hi.
Happy to be here with you today to share some of what I've learned about resilience and how that might be relevant to ourselves as human beings and to our clients who may be looking for ways to recover and strengthen their resilience so they can navigate their lives more flexibly and move toward their goals more skillfully. Years ago, when I told my brother I was writing a book on resilience, he said, "Resilience, what's that?" "Oh, I know. It's bouncing back from the terrible." It is, and that's where I got the title of my book, Bouncing Back. The American Psychological Association has published its formal definition of resilience. Resilience is the process of adapting well in the face of adversity, trauma, tragedy, threats, or significant sources of stress. That's true enough. And what I appreciate about that definition is that it focuses on resilience as a process, not the nouns of one particular trait like perseverance or even a constellation of traits, though those traits can be essential. It focuses on processes, the verbs of adapting well. And because we know from neuroscience that the brain learns and changes and grows lifelong, and that the brain learns and develops and rewires itself from experience and only from experience, we can trust the process of guiding clients toward the experiences, the verbs, that will create new processes of coping with any distress or even disaster in their lives, and that will rewire old previous patterns of coping when those patterns of response no longer work so well. Because of the neuroplasticity innate in the brain, resilience is learnable and recoverable and trainable when we know how. And we can guide our clients in the processes of recovering their resilience in ways that are safe, efficient, and effective. So two quotes from the research on resilience and dealing with stress and trauma from Kelly McGonigal, a health psychologist at Stanford University, in her book, The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. Resilience is not about being untouched by adversity or unruffled by difficulties. It's about allowing stress to awaken in you these core human strengths of courage, connection, and growth. Whether you are looking at resilience in overworked executives or war-torn communities, people in military deployment, immigrants or refugees, people living in poverty, battling cancer, or raising a child with autism, the same themes emerge. People who are resilient allow themselves to be changed by the experience of adversity. They maintain a basic sense of trust in themselves and a connection to something bigger than themselves. They also find ways to make meaning out of suffering. To be resilient is not to avoid difficulty, but to play an active role in how difficulty transforms you. And from Stephen Southwick and Dennis Charney, psychiatrists at Yale University, in their book, Resilience, The Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges. People who are resilient tend to be flexible. Flexible in the way they think about challenges, and flexible in the way they react emotionally to stress. They're not wedded to a specific style of coping. Instead, they shift from one coping strategy to another, depending on the circumstances. Many are able to accept what they cannot change, to learn from failure, to use emotions like grief and anger to fuel compassion and courage, and to search for opportunity and meaning in adversity. So part of the framework for our understanding of resilience is that all of us have choices about how we respond to any perceived challenge or crisis. As my colleague Frankie Perez says, how you respond to the issue is the issue. This would lead to Carol Dweck's research on mindsets, fixed mindsets and growth mindsets, and how we help clients shift from fixed to growth. So psychologist Carol Dweck wrote her book Mindset 12 years ago while she was at Columbia University and focused on the difference between a fixed mindset and a growth mindset in how we deal with failure, and setbacks, and disappointments. She focused on success as the positive outcome rather than resilience, but her differentiation between a fixed mindset and a growth mindset is especially applicable to resilience. So her findings boil down to, in a fixed mindset, that's a system of beliefs that talents and aptitudes and temperaments and personality traits and preferences are fixed. Either you have the smarts or the good looks or the talents, or you don't, and that success or failure is a true measure of one's intelligence, competence, and self-worth. Dweck doesn't refer to shame in her research, but folks with the fixed mindset feel an urgency to prove over and over again that they are as good as they believe they are, or more likely that others believe they are, to meet expectations, to succeed, to never fail. Hence, folks with a fixed mindset are super sensitive to being judged and very vulnerable to feeling rejected, a failure, an idiot, a loser, worthless, nobody loves me, or pitiful. And the response to a failure or a setback is to fear challenge, to devalue effort and avoid risk, to stop trying, to give up, retreat, withdraw, and veg out. The fixed mindset robs people of capacities to cope. The growth mindset is a system of beliefs that talents, aptitudes, temperaments, personality traits, and preferences are simply a starting point for development. The growth mindset fosters curiosity and a passion for learning through effort and experience. People with growth mindsets respond especially well when things are not going well. They tend to stretch themselves confronting obstacles, embrace risk, and stick through the hard times. Rather than being embarrassed or blocked by a sense of deficiency, they can acknowledge what skill or capacity is missing and set to work to cultivate it. They take direct, wise, and compassionate action. Love of challenge, belief in effort, resilience in the face of setbacks, greater creativity and success are hallmarks of the growth mindset. And in Dweck's view, we can intentionally choose to cultivate a growth mindset that would be characteristic of the growth mindset right there. Our mindsets are not fixed. We can put in the effort to shift our orientation to life events from fixed to growth. We can shift how we filter our perceptions of ourselves and our experiences. That means we live our lives not about avoiding failure or distress, but about grabbing a hold of failure or distress as an opportunity to learn, to improve, to master. Choosing to cultivate a growth mindset changes everything. So there's an exercise in my book, Resilience, that I teach in all of my workshops, of helping people shift from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. I'm just going to describe it very quickly. Of course, you would take more time to do this with a client. Take a moment to reflect on many different situations where you faced a challenge, or even simply something new or unknown. Reflect on your own thought process and your own behaviors. Discern times when you did hang back, hesitate, or refuse to attempt something you perceived a bit beyond your capacity. Discern times also when you approached a challenge as a learning opportunity with interest, curiosity, and some confidence, at least a willingness to give it a go. Most of us have experienced elements of both fixed mindset and growth mindset. For one of your times acting from a growth mindset, reflect on what made your decision to try and your perseverance in trying possible. Identify both internal and external resources. For one of your times being caught in a fixed mindset, imagine how you could have behaved differently, finding your courage and encouragement from others to go ahead and try, engage, persevere, try again and again until you experience some success, or at least a healthy pride in your effort. And identify a new situation now where you could try, coming from a growth mindset rather than a fixed mindset. Choose a situation where you might realistically have a chance for success. Focus on shifting your mindset from fixed to growth. And reflect on any difference this choice makes on your behavior. What will you do when a setback or adversity happens? So this exercise helps clients move toward a more resilient mindset. Now, cultivating a resilience mindset may be far down the road toward the end of the process of recovering and strengthening resilience. My teaching follows the organization of the book, Resilience, leading people in practices that install resources for resilience from the bottom up and the inside out. Somatic body-based tools to regulate the nervous system, tools of breath and touch and movement and visualization to return the nervous system to its baseline equilibrium of calm and relaxed, yet engaged and alert. That equilibrium is called many things: window of tolerance, zone of safety. I call it range of resilience. It's essential to resilience, not too revved up in the fight flight of the overmobilization of the sympathetic, not too shut down or collapsed in the immobilization of the parasympathetic. And from that neuroception of safety, the brain is primed for learning and growth. Next, emotional intelligence, because we experience some emotion or another every living moment of every day. And knowing how to experience and manage our emotions skillfully is also essential to the optimal functioning of our brains. 25 years of behavioral science research and 25 years of neuroscience research are dovetailing nicely now to explain how cultivating positive emotions, gratitude, kindness, compassion, awe, joy, delight, serenity, actually shift the functioning of the brain out of contraction, reactivity, negativity, into more receptivity, openness to learning, and thus the bigger picture, and more optimism. The direct, measurable, cause and effect outcome of experiencing positive emotions on a steady basis is resilience. It might be very helpful to remind clients of that as you encourage them to focus on a moment of kindness they offer or receive from other people throughout the day. It's just as essential to work skillfully with negative emotions, fear, anger, shame, so they don't derail our resilient decision-making either. There are many tools of mindful self-compassion in the book Resilience, and these days I teach a simple ABC method of working with difficult or negative emotions. The acronym ABC is easy to remember. It's easily applicable to helping clients work with their emotions. A is becoming aware of what is happening and our reactions to what is happening, attuning to the felt sense of our experience and our reactions to the experience, allowing what's happening and allowing our reactions to what's happening to be there, accepting that this is what is happening, accepting that I am reacting this way to what's happening, even accepting reactions to reactions to reactions. B is for being with or befriending, being with a disturbing emotion or body sensation or thought or belief. Before we try to change or fix them, being with and befriending, recognizing that any emotion or sensation is a signal to pay attention. Something important is happening here before trying to change or fix it. C is for compassionate connection, because compassionate connection, whether from ourselves or from another, is what activates the release of oxytocin, the hormone of safety and trust, returning our nervous system to that state of baseline physiological equilibrium, the Goldilocks state of neither too revved up nor too shut down. Compassionate connection is what creates that sense of safety. C could also stand for curiosity. When a client feels safe enough, they can become curious about what any emotion or body sensation is trying to tell them. I teach clients and workshop participants practices to cultivate these intelligences from the bottom up. But of course, they're all always working together simultaneously, and I'm listening for them simultaneously. For relational intelligence within, I'm listening for the negative, critical, shaming, blaming self-talk that some clients might believe is actually motivational, but the research shows that compassion and acceptance for oneself, all of one's facets and parts and voices, the integration of all of those experiences and memories that constellate who we are, leads to far more success in meeting one's goals and in moving into a sense of well-being. So ABC with all of the inner dialogue as well. In relational intelligence with others, I focus on healthy, resonant connection and healthy limits and boundaries. Being able to dance between dependence and independence in a rhythm and flow of conscious and compassionate interdependence. And then reflective intelligence, the mindfulness which we've been using all along, to pause and pay attention to our experience, to notice what's happening and our reactions to what's happening, also to notice what's working and what's not working, to discern options and make wise choices. So two quotes that can summarize that intelligence from my friend Janet Friedman: catch the moment, make a choice. And from the environmental activist Julia Butterfly Hill: every moment has a choice, and every choice has an impact. So that's the trajectory of resilience right there, and it comes back full circle to Frankie Perez. How you respond to the issue is the issue. And to encourage that responding in the direction of learning from adversity, playing an active role in how adversity transforms you. I also very much appreciate the perspective of James Russell Lowell. Mishaps are like knives that either cut us or serve us as we grasp them by the blade or by the handle. When our mindfulness, seeing clearly and choosing wisely, is integrated with the functioning of the prefrontal cortex, the higher brain's center of executive functioning, known as the CEO of resilience, then we are integrating our seeing clearly with our analysis, judgment, planning, decision-making. Then people can make truly wise choices. They can shift from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. They can learn from their experiences and transform any adversity into learning and growth. Thank you very much for your attention. And now, if there are any questions.
I have a question. This is Carol from Ashland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Carol.
Hi. First of all, I read your book this weekend, and it was like a deep meditation breath. It was so wonderful. And I've been a meditator an active meditator for over 40 years. So there wasn't much in the book that I haven't experienced on one side of the spectrum to the other. And my question is one thing that happened, I noticed in the book when I was reading about the teacher who had the students write down all their classmates and then say one wonderful thing about them. I just immediately burst into tears. It was just, it so moved me. And so my question is really about what happens in the brain and the physiology when one is moved to cry, which I am frequently.
It's what my mentor, Diana Fosha, who developed accelerated experiential dynamic psychotherapy, would call happy tears. Happy tears. It's a recognition of the upwelling of positive emotion, of a sense of safety and trust, love and acceptance, and that we are moved to respond to that physiologically. We respond to those emotions by what she calls happy tears. So when that happens for me or anyone else, I simply try to normalize that. And in fact, to even take a moment to savor that and take in the felt sense of that, because it can be a beautiful, opening, liberating kind of experience.
Well, that's the way I see it, and that's the way I feel it. But it was never mentioned, and I wondered, what is this thing? You know, and do you know what chemicals get released during that time?
So any time a sense of safety and trust is evoked, it's the oxytocin, which is the hormone of safety and trust, of bonding and belonging, of tend and befriend. And it's actually the brain's direct an immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. They're released at the same time in the HPA axis. So whenever there's stress and cortisol is released, the oxytocin can also be released, especially if we're in connection with safe others or have a safe, accepting relationship with ourselves. And then the oxytocin brings us back to that sense of equilibrium. So that's what's happening.
That's what I thought, but I just thought it would be really fun to ask you this question since it came up while I was reading your book.
Right. And this, Carol, this is the first year in 10 years that I have not been to Ashland for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I had my tickets. Everything was closed down. I donated my tickets. I'll be there again next year.
Well, and you mentioned in your acknowledgments Shoshana Alexander. And I know that name, I know that person, but I haven't actually met her. So that was kind of, that's why I thought you had some sort of,
when I was writing the book, I would come up to Ashland for the Shakespeare Festival, but Shoshana and I would meet and walk along Lithia Creek. And so, yes, she was completely instrumental in the development of that book, Bouncing Back. I hope you do get to meet her someday.
I would love to. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Linda, I thought it was a really, it's a very interesting approach that you're taking with regard to resiliency and the notion that people can learn how to become resilient. So I did some training with the Trauma Institute out in California, resiliency training. And so I'm curious because I really enjoyed your opening comments when you were talking about the goal, express goal, is to kind of move people from a fixed to a growth mindset. And so when you when you get a client, for example, or you're working with a client and you recognize that that's what's going on, I mean, you use the language. You mentioned something about a verb. You start moving them toward verbs. I believe that's what you said. I may have misheard that, but I'm kind of curious and wondering if you could go into greater detail about that.
Well, besides being a coach and a therapist, I've been a trauma specialist for 17 years. So I know that when people are in the shutdown or dissociation of trauma, they need to be able to feel safe in their body, safe in their mind, safe in their experience, safe in their relationship with me. And so a lot of the tools used early on in somatic intelligence, emotional intelligence, are to create that sense of safety and to have it noticed and felt and taken in. When there's a sense of safety in the brain, that's when the brain is primed for neuroplasticity. That's when the brain can learn and change and grow. So all of the other tools that I might offer about reflective intelligence or relational intelligence, the brain can now be open and curious and ready to learn about them. So I'm trying to offer clients the experiences that will help them feel safe, help them recognize and know that they are learning, that they are changing and growing, that they can learn and change and grow. They begin to see themselves as a learner. They begin to see themselves as resilient, even if it's on a smaller scale. And then we're moving, I mean, another way of looking at the fixed mindset to the growth mindset is to look at moving into post-traumatic growth and looking at the learning about an event or a series of events or a lifetime accumulation of events. Looking at those events, looking for the learning, the gift and the mistake, the silver lining. What did I do that worked? What could I have done better that worked? What could I do now preparing going forward? So every sense of the way we're tracking the client's sense of change and movement, but most importantly, that they can instigate or they can initiate that sense of movement and change so that they feel like they're the ones creating the resilience.
Wow. And typically when you're working with clients, I'm sorry, just a quick follow-up. Typically when you're working with clients, how long of a process is that for you? I mean, that as has been your experience.
So we know that it is absolutely impossible to predict how long. It so depends on the severity of the external stressor. It depends on the strength of external resources. It depends on the strength of the internal resources and the capacity of the client to validate and recognize those internal resources. So there's no magic number either in neuroscience or in behavioral science of how long this process might take. I look for small movement. The brain learns best little and often. Small experiences repeated many times. So any glimmer, any movement, I will pounce on it and say, did you notice that? What's different? What does it feel like to you to notice something different? Any movement I work with. Because once a client gets the sense of, oh, I'm moving, I'm changing, I'm growing, that's the motivation, that's self-reinforcing, then they're more likely to keep using the practices and keep doing the exercises because they know that they can create the change that they want.
Thank you. It's so excellent. This is such an excellent presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ditto on your presentation, Linda, and your book. It just sounds like there are so many implications here and so many practical applications. So my mind is just going wild right now. just popping off with all the wonderful things, possibilities. Thank you.
So then let me say this. I encourage clients to choose two or three of the exercises and get some experience and sense of accomplishment that they can master two or three of these practices. And then again, that's motivating to go on and do some more. It's not about doing everything all at once. It's doing something that works at a steady pace so that the motivation continues, and then over time they can really expand.
Hi, Linda. This is Joe. I'm calling from the D.C. metro area. When we refer to the term resilience, I'm going to make a statement, then I'm going to ask the question. For me, and Dr. Kruger knows a lot about my background, my story, but I'm a retired combat vet. And I actually died twice on the operating table due to being a casualty of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so coming out of the hospital, learning how to walk, talk again, and to get life back on track with combat PTSD, depression, and suicidal thoughts, and all these different things. And I did 13 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan in my 26-year career. So the doctors and nurses and many people said, you have a lot of resilience. And so my question has always been, are we born with resiliency, or is it earned? Is it something that we learn through experience? So that's my question to you.
Okay, excellent question, and deep bows to everything that you have been through and the courage and perseverance it has taken you to come back and even be here with us today. I mean, really, Joe, deep bows. So resilience, we're born with the capacities for resilience. All of those capacities are innate in the brain. How they develop very much depends on our experience, especially in relationship with our early caregivers, relationship with other people, relationships where our own resilience can be reflected back to us when people see us as courageous or persevering or motivated or, you know, have a lot of grit. And so we do learn from experience. That's why resilience is learnable and trainable and recoverable, because we can choose the experiences that in fact will rewire the brain, that will allow that resilience to grow and install in our neural circuitry. So that's why it's important that healthcare professionals and coaches and therapists and family members, whoever, know the kinds of experiences that help people feel stronger within themselves. And that's what I try to teach in sort of this streamlined program in resilience, bottom up, beginning with breath and touch and movement, and going through emotions and going through how we relate to ourselves and other people, and then how we bring our awareness and our curiosity to that. So the resilience is learnable. We can learn it and earn it by choosing the right experiences that will help us go in that direction and having people around us that also help us go in that direction. So thank you for your question, and thank you for your learning and growth.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think we have heard a masterful use of the foundation of a relationship and the concept of safety to really facilitate transformation and transformation of identity at the same time, which is what makes change permanent. So it's been a privilege, Linda, to have you with us. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you. I know we're out of time. I appreciate your energy and input, and as always, if I can be of help to you, please let me know. Thanks so much for making this a very special reunion. Take good care.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Linda, and Jill, thank you for your service.
Dave, thanks, Linda.
Thank you all.
Yeah, and thanks for the great advice, guys. Really appreciate it. Linda, Lisa, Gloria, and TJ, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Take good care of yourself. Bye.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.